Mark chapter 5. Mark chapter 5. We finished up Mark chapter 4 last week with talking about the coming of, Jesus calming the storm. And such an amazing miracle that was. And we have a series of miracles that are being discussed here, and just how amazing and wonderful those miracles are. And the first one, of course, calming the sea. Calming the Sea of Galilee is such a dramatic display of his abilities. But here also, this next thing, you know, it's a casting out of a demon, which may seem ho-hum, at least compared to what Jesus has already accomplished thus far. But what we see here is that this is actually one of the most dramatic displays, at least in my opinion, one of the most dramatic displays of a demon possession and expulsion recorded in the New Testament. The second only to, the second most dramatic, I think, might be in Acts chapter 19 with the seven sons of Sceva. At least that's my opinion on that. And here we have this particular instance of demon possession and the casting out of that demon. Is again, remarkable event here that's recorded. If you will, somebody please read the whole story spans 20 verses, the first 20 verses of chapter 5. So if you will, please read Mark chapter 5, verses 1 through 20.
Then they came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gadarenes. And when he had come out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit, who had his dwelling among the tombs. And no one could bind him, not even with chains, because he had often been bound with shackles and the chains had been pulled apart by him, and the shackles broken in pieces. Neither could anyone tame him. And always, night and day, he was in the mountains, crying out and cutting himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and worshipped him. And he cried out with a loud voice and says, What have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God that you do not torment me. For he said to him, Come out of the man, unclean spirit. Then he asked him, What is your name? And he answered, saying, My name is Legion, for we are many. Also he begged him earnestly that he would not send them out of the country. Now a large herd of swine was feeding there near the mountain, so all the demons begged him, saying, send us to the swine that we may enter them. And at once Jesus gave them permission. Then the unclean spirits went out and entered the swine. There were about 2,000. And the herd ran violently down the steep place into the sea and drowned in the sea. So those who fed the swine fled, and they told it in the city and in the country. And they went out to see what had happened. Then they came to Jesus and saw the one who had been demon-possessed and had the legion sitting and clothed and in his right mind. And they were afraid. And those who saw it told them how it happened to him who had been demon-possessed and about the swine. Then they began to plead with him to depart from their region. And when he got into the boat, he who had been demon-possessed begged that he might be with him. However, Jesus did not permit him, but said to him, Go home to your friends and tell them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he has had compassion on you. And he departed and began to proclaim to Decapolis all that Jesus had done for him, and all marveled.
All right. I know that was fairly lengthy, but, you know, it's the whole fancy word for that is a pericope, where you have a whole story, a whole group of text together. Anyway, that's what we have here. The first thing that I like to look at is where this took place. Remember, last week we looked at how they had crossed the Sea of Galilee, and they were, it doesn't say where they started off at, but it was likely in Capernaum. That was where his headquarters was, and that's the general consensus about where he was located when he first started off. And he crossed the Sea of Galilee, and different accounts, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, as well as different manuscripts, say different things about where they were exactly. And one of them is in Gergesa, and another one is in Gadara, which is really down here, but there's a harbor for Gadara right there. Now, it says in Mark chapter 1 here in this in the manuscript that the King James is taken from, the country of the Gadarenes. And so there's Gadara down here and the harbor for Gadara right there. Now, the question then is, where exactly was this? Now, there are different, I have the different versions up here. Matthew states that in the TR stands for Textus Receptus, which is the manuscript that the King James is from. So that is, if you see TR, then that's basically, you can read that as King James. And so for Matthew chapter, Matthew's version in the King James, it says the Gergesenes. In Matthew's version, in the WH, is my version of Westcott Hort, it's the critical text that a lot of the other more modern translations come from. And that's like the ESV, the NIV, and the New American Standard. So they all are taken from the more critical texts. And they claim to have better manuscripts. They say better. Basically, what it is what they perceive to be earlier manuscripts. And so that's where they get that from. So anyway, the King James in Matthew says the country of the Gergesenes. In the King James in Mark and Luke, it says the country of the Gadarenes. But in the other versions, it says, in Matthew, it says the country of the Gadarenes. And in Mark and Luke, it says the country of the Gerasenes. Now, question, is this a problem?
Probably if it's Gerasenes, because that's a long way from the lake.
The answer is, it's absolutely not a problem. Not a problem at all. Because note, it says the country of the Gadarenes, the country of the Gerasenes, the country of the Gergesenes. This is all in the same region called Decapolis. And we note that in verse 20 of Mark chapter 1, that this is that the man, once he's healed, he goes around all of Decapolis. And so this is all in the region of Decapolis. So then the question is, why is it different in each of these? Well, consider the audience, the primary audience that is reading these things. What's Matthew's, generally considered to be Matthew's primary audience? The people that he's writing to. Typically, it's understood that he's writing to Jews. And we note that because of all the Old Testament references and things of that nature. So we note that is entirely possible that there's that particular thing. Who is Mark writing to? We already talked about that in the intro several months ago. Do you remember? Churches. Pardon?
Churches, so this Gentile and Jews converted.
He's Mark. We understand it to be he's writing to Roman Christians. Roman Christians. That's kind of the general consensus a lot of people have. Now Luke, who's he writing to? His primary audience. Greek or Gentile Christians. So he's a little bit more generic. for instance, here's an example of why this isn't a problem. When I was living in Ohio for a few months and people asked me where I was from, I would say, eventually I ended up just saying the Carolinas, because they don't really know much of a difference between North and South, at least the people I talked to. So I just said, from the Carolinas. Now, at the time, and it was still the case back then, but I was originally from South Carolina, but also lived in North Carolina, so it's not entirely inaccurate either. So I just told them the Carolinas. Whenever I was living in Virginia or Florida, they're a little bit more familiar with the Carolinas and the differences, and I told them where I was originally from, South Carolina. and sometimes people knew a little bit more closely, so I would often say near Charleston. Here, I would tell people, I can't just say South Carolina because that's just an hour away, a little less than an hour away. So I tell people from the Lowcountry of South Carolina. And in the Lowcountry, whenever I'm down there, I tell people, well, I'm from near Somerville, or even if they're more familiar because it's a small town, I tell people I'm from Ridgeville, or perhaps even in the more local area, I'll tell them, oh, you know that house down 61 where, you know, that I tell people that kind of thing. So it's, and you're all of you do this, I'm sure, do something similar to that. So Matthew's Jewish audience, primary audience, is going to understand where Gergesa is and understand that that's a bit closer. They're going to understand where Gadara is. So either or, not a huge deal. Whereas the Gentile and Roman audiences, they're not going to be familiar with Gergesa, and they might be familiar with Gadara, but Gerasa, so you kind of build up on these. Gergesa is very small. Gadara is a fairly prominent city in the region of Decapolis, but it's not nearly as prominent as Gerasa. So if you say in the country of the Gerasenes or the country of the Gadarenes, likely the Gentiles might understand you a little bit better, the Gentiles who are not from that area. So that's another thing. And then, you know, some of this, you know how similar some of these names are? It's entirely possible that there was a copyist error at some point that had crept up, especially with these names looking very much alike. But as we note, none of them are significant enough to pose any real issue, to pose any real problem. Because again, it's in the same region of Decapolis. Gergesa is kind of on the border, so it could have been in a different region, but typically, you know, it's close enough that it's not an issue.
Stephen, one of the things that we often forget is they didn't have Google Maps. Yeah. They didn't have maps for the most part. The common person didn't have a map. You know, they weren't used to looking at the geography. They'd say, well, you know, up there by the lake, over to this side of the lake, you know, or to the northeast, or it'd be a very vague general reference, or it'd be along a road or a river that people knew.
Right.
And so a lot of this, you know, we look at it and we go, well, that's 1.2 miles away from that other one. You know, it's like that wouldn't matter to them. It's like the time of day. You know, they don't say this happened at 8:32 in the morning. They said it happened in the morning, you know.
Or they do say what hour often, yeah. Like the third hour of the morning or third hour of the day, right. Things of that nature. And then at night they have during the first watch, second watch, third watch. And you can understand how they understood time, and you can understand where certain things took place, or when certain things took place roundabout. especially Acts 2 is the one that really springs to mind. You know, it says it's the third hour of the day. These people aren't drunk, which is about 9 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. So you get that time reference and these geographical references, which indicate a location, but sort of a general region. And that's what we have here. The country of the Gadarenes, Gergesenes, Gerasenes, all in the general location. So let's go back to this one. Here, we note these, that there are some cliffs over here. And this is, again, very likely where these occurred. Now, these cliffs actually begin right around, or at least begin right around here near Gergesa, and come all the way down here to this harbor for Gadara. So these very likely could have happened or did happen in some of these areas. Now, the question now is, he was living in tombs. So where have we found tombs? There have been tombs found the more southern areas. So it's likely to have occurred more closer to the Gadara area. So they found tombs in that area. So it's likely there. So let's look at that one. Here's a map that I found of the region that is looking at it from the position of the Sea of Galilee, but you also see some of the topography. And some of the cities as well. Again, Gergesa is here, Gadara is over here, and the harbor for Gadara is over here somewhere. And then there are some other cities, Amatha and Hippos, which are there, and they'll come in handy in understanding the story a little bit later on. And so as I mentioned last week, that's about 8 miles from Gergesa to around the harbor for Gadara. And then you see the cliffs right here, that kind of steep, come up a bit, kind of slowly. Then you have this little bit of a valley, and then some more cliffs over here. All right, so that's the region and how it pretty much looks like, or looked like. All right, so in this story, we read about this demon-possessed man, and he comes to Jesus. Now, as I mentioned earlier, he was living in the tombs. And in other words, he was living among the dead. Probably, based on what we read about him, probably the only people who were willing to put up with him. Some are located close to the, So the demon, it notes, we note here that there's some indications that he has had superhuman strength. Now, and I wonder, and I think, I like sci-fi, but they so much don't consider certain things. So if you have super strength, well, that's amazing. But the problem with that is in the situations that are described here, he would break the shackles and the chains. He would pull them apart, and no one could tame him. The problem, so there's two things. One, you might have the strength to do that, but could your skin handle the chafing and the problems that occur there? So there are a couple things that I consider here. Either his pain receptors were numbed, and he couldn't feel the pain that would be associated with that strength, or because he wasn't really in control, the demon caused him to ignore the pain. And so think about how tormented this man, and I think the latter is more likely just because of how insidious and evil these demons are. Think about how awful that would be, where you would feel all the pain that came from breaking these chains and these shackles, and yet you're not going to stop because you can't stop, but you're still in agony over it. Yeah.
Another thing to keep in mind, too, is the use of metal. We think chains and shackles today, nobody would even use a chain unless it's steel. Right. That wasn't what they were using steel for. These could have been copper chains, would have been a lot more common, or other things that were more malleable. And they could still be very strong, but they could still be, you would say today, if somebody tied somebody up with, half-inch thick steel chain, anyone would be going to break it. So it's a different kind of situation. And the other thing you know, too, about him later, so he's out in the tombs crying out and cutting himself with stones. So he's doing a lot of self-inflicted damage to himself anyway. Yeah. But it does say he's crying out. So either he's just tormented or he's hurting one or the other.
Yeah. We know that he was such a terror that people... So I hadn't considered what the shackles were made of, so that's a good point. He was such a terror that people tried to restrain him but could not. He was crying out, as I mentioned here. He even resorted to self-mutilation. And then we note that he first recognized who Jesus was. He identified who Jesus was. Remember the last verse of chapter 4? Who is this who can control the wind and the sea? Who is this? Well, this demon here answers that question. He identifies Jesus. What have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? He says in verse 7. And then, at the same time, in verse 6, we note that he worships Jesus. I don't think this is the kind of worship that we typically think of. Because he is a demon, he is not that kind of worship that we might understand to be. This word worship is the Greek word proskuneo, which is basically, it literally means to kiss the hand. So when it says that he worshiped Jesus, I don't think he bowed down to honor him, really. I think what he was doing was he was just bowing down and perhaps just showing the humility that is due Jesus, if not from a heartfelt perspective. Yes?
You have a real indication, because the very next thing he says is, don't torment me, don't cast me off.
Well, he knows who he is.
You have a strong sense of fear here, uh-huh. and a recognition of his power. And you know, there's that verse that says, every knee shall bow. You know?
Yeah.
There are going to be people bowing in that kind of worship to Jesus who absolutely have no desire to worship him like we do. Because he is King of Kings, and they will bow,
right.
whether they like it or not.
Well, I don't think, one of the things I don't think, because we note that earlier he wouldn't accept the confessions of any of the earlier demons. Mm-hmm. So I don't think he's going to accept the worship of a demon either, the heartfelt, true worship that we engage in, at least on a weekly basis. But at the same time, we note that this demon, he clearly wanted something. It says, don't torment me, he says. Implore you, by God, that you do not torment me. He wanted something from Jesus. What do you do to someone that you want something from? I'm sorry, several people talked at once. Joy?
You're good to them.
Yeah.
Nice to them.
You're nice?
Do whatever they ask.
All right, right. You. I mean, I haven't experienced this yet because my kids aren't quite that savvy yet. But when you're, some of you have had kids, no doubt, who, when they want something, are they super nice? Are they so perfectly obedient? Yeah, oh yeah. Do you want something? do you want the keys to the car? Is that what's going on here? Something of that nature, right? And so that, I believe, is what this particular demon is doing. He wants something from Jesus, so he's being super nice, super humble, in order to try to get on Jesus' good side. Yes?
I think it's helpful to understand and separate the fact that there is a human being here who is the body, and then there is more than one demon in him.
Yes.
It's talking plural demons, many demons, that we are legion and us. You know, send us to the slime, that sort of thing. But it's important, I think, for me to understand anyway, that this is a person, and separate him from the demons who are inside him, controlling him, hurting him, breaking the chains, giving him the force to break the chains.
Right. Yeah, and so Jesus is also showing, he will show compassion upon this man. But before he gets there, the demon is in the driver's seat. We note here that in verse, you know, this was kind of an interesting thing, trying to understand what was going on here. It says that in verse 7, we already reread that, where he says he identifies Jesus, he asks Jesus for a favor, don't torment me. And then it says, for he said to him, come out of the man, unclean spirit. Really, we could look at this and say he was saying. This is in the imperfect tense. And an imperfect tense is an event that occurred in the past, but a continual event that occurred in the past. So this was going on, this used to go on, this continued to go on, this kind of thing. So he had already started, once he approached the man, saying things in order to cast out the demon. But the demon was like, hold on. He begged him not to torment him. And again, indicating, this is indicated by the imperfect tense and also by the four in verse 8. So that because he was doing this, he didn't want him to continue. Torment. The torment was to send him back, as we understand in Second Peter chapter 2 and verse 4. We had our Bible class on Wednesday night about that a few weeks ago. The torment was to send him back to hell, and not hell in the sense that we understand it as the final judgment, but the torments, what Peter calls in the Greek Tartarus, right? To be reserved for a judgment. And that's not a pleasant place. We read about that place, a particular account in Luke chapter 16, right? How he was tormented in the flame. And so that's where the demons reside as well, unless they're let out for whatever reason. All right, and so they are reserved there for judgment. And then Jesus asks him his name. You know, this almost has a movie quality to it, this particular event. And that's why I mean by one of the most dramatic instances of demon possession here that we read about in the scriptures. This almost has a movie quality to it. And I can just picture just how, in my mind, I've always read, "My name is Legion," in this deep, gravelly voice. And yeah, I know. But I picture the same thing in Acts 19, where the, you know, I know Jesus I know, Paul I know, but who are you? You know, this kind of creepy, like, skin-crawling event that is happening. And that's just how I picture it in my mind. Maybe it happened that way, maybe it didn't. At the very least, we know that he's not just any demon, he is several demons. And all together, they are called Legion. Now, yes?
It is really unusual. You mentioned this a little bit. It's really unusual. One, it's the only situation where he asks for a name. Hmm. But we do know that spiritual beings have names. We know of angels that have names, like Michael or Abaddon or Gabriel, right, that are mentioned in Scripture.
Right.
And we have where Joshua was wrestling with the angel, right? He said, "What is your name?" You know, you get the idea that it's there, but it just seems really unusual, the relationship that and the interchange that Jesus is having here in this situation is really different. Most of the other ones, he just says, "Come out," and they're out and gone. That's it. You know, so it's just fascinating that it's that detailed here.
And again, this is the only the version of this particular story. I believe Mark is the only one that actually states the name of the demon and calls him Legion. Collectively, these demons are called Legion. Now, a Roman legion consisted of about 6,000 soldiers. So there could have been, when he says legion, he could literally mean, 6,000 demons within him. Or he could just be indicating it's a very large number. Because sometimes that word is used. You know, we might say myriads, which is, I believe, Greek for thousands, or a thousand. A myriad is a thousand. But for instance, decimation is literally one-tenth being destroyed, but we think of it as destruction, generally speaking. So when he says legion, he could be thinking of just a whole lot of them. We know that a little bit later on in verse 13, I believe, that there were 2,000 pigs that the demons were cast into. So we might be able to say that there were at least 2,000 demons within the man. And so if it is 6,000, though, then that means there's possibly 3 demons per pig.
If they got divided up that way.
We
don't know.
Wouldn't want that big.
We might say on average 3 demons per pig. All right. So, the demon, now this is an interesting thing. The demon begs not to be sent out, but rather into a herd of pigs. Now, honestly, I do not know why that's any better. Because then the pigs, the pigs are gonna die. Where are the demons gonna go? Whatever happens after this, I suppose maybe in some spiritual understanding, then this is better. Something that I don't personally understand, but maybe that is the case. We understand, what is the status of the pig in Jewish law?
Unclean.
They're unclean, right? Now, for some reason, everybody picks on the pig, but there are quite a few unclean animals in Scripture. I think one of the reasons why they pick on the pig, though, is because they are often in farms and eaten, especially back then. Decapolis, the whole region, was a Gentile region. So this is why they had herds of pigs around. Whereas if this were in a Jewish region, they certainly would not have had herds of pigs around. So one question I have on here, and I have it up on the board too. Does Jesus show mercy to a demon?
Well, he gave them what they asked.
His basis was to show mercy on the man who was being possessed.
Yeah. But Alvin's right. He does do what the demon requested. He doesn't send him straight back to Tartarus. He sends him into the pigs, just like the demon asked to happen. So I do think there is some level of mercy that is shown to the demon. And now I think that's remarkable.
You also have a situation where God uses the intents of wicked people for his own will. You have that, all kinds of situations like that, where the wicked kings or whatever that God uses. And in this situation, there's the other aspect of what happens, this demonstration of Jesus' power, because it's, you know, just like today, there are people who claim that they're casting demons out of people, right? I mean, they're not running around breaking chains and throwing everybody off like that. But they'll sit there and say, oh, this person's demon-possessed. Yeah, they look crazy. Oh, now they're healed, and there's like no way of telling. And there's no evidence. All of a sudden, there's 2,000 pigs running off of a cliff into the ocean. Into the lake. That was a demonstration as well.
Wow. Well, true. Whatever the case, my point of bringing that up, if Jesus is willing to show mercy to a demon, is he willing to show mercy to you? Now, I think that's powerful. If he's willing to show, now this is not mercy in the sense that we receive mercy and grace.
It's not forgiveness, that's for sure.
Certainly not. This is. I think this shows that his eagerness to grant mercy, even if it's just for a little bit. The demon will still face judgment, certainly, but he was still granted a brief reprieve. And if the demon is granted that, what are we granted? Especially through the blood of Jesus. So I think that's an interesting point there. The pigs then promptly, as Sam had mentioned earlier, the pigs promptly go wild and run off a cliff and drown in the Sea of Galilee. It says specifically they die of drowning, not from running off the cliff. Now, one of the reasons why I mentioned that is the cliff is actually kind of far away from the sea. So it's not as if they fall into the ocean, or fall into the sea, rather. It kind of reminds me, whenever I saw a map like this, and I'm trying to picture this in my head. Did you ever see the movie The Lion King? Do you remember the wildebeest stampede scene? Where Simba is in the middle of the valley, and the wildebeest are coming down. So they're going down a cliff, right? So the wildebeest don't die from that fall. They keep going. So I kind of picture that in my head, not wildebeest obviously, but pigs. And the pigs are going down the cliff, and they're running around, and then they then run, they keep running, because it's a little wild to the sea, they keep running, and then they end up drowning in the sea. So that's how I picture that in my head. It says specifically they die of drowning, not from falling off the cliff. Yes?
One thing to keep in mind, too, we're looking at modern topography and modern land. If the lake was higher, then it would be closer to the water from the cliff. I mean, or it could be lower.
Maybe.
Vary over time. But it's just important to realize when we're looking at topography, we're looking at modern topography.
Yeah.
All those ridges there are there from erosion. Those are erosion ridges. So, the longer it takes, the more erosion there is. There's different things like that you have to keep in mind.
Well, yeah. Though I've seen, I haven't read any indication that it looks much different or looked much different back then.
Right. Yeah. We didn't have a topographic map on this.
Well, so, and then we note that the keepers of the pigs, they go and tell everybody about this. Now, these may be the actual owners of the pigs, or now, would you, if you own these pigs, would you be a little bit upset?
Yes.
These might not be the owners of the pigs. These might be just the hired hands, because it just said they're the keepers. And it says that they go into the cities and into the countries to tell people, so in the urban and rural areas. And then we note a couple cities they could have gone to. If it was in this location or around here, which is likely, they could have gone to Amatha or Gadara or Hippos. And if it happened over here, it could have been in Gergesa and Hippos as well. So they go into the cities and tell all these things. Yes, Frank?
I imagine they were in big trouble. They lost all that dust. So it belonged to somebody.
Yeah.
Somebody's property.
Well, they turned around and asked Jesus to leave.
Exactly. They asked Jesus to leave. That's right. Well, and we do note that being Gentiles, let's see, do I have enough? Being Gentiles, they didn't quite know what to think about what happened. They might have heard about things like this, particularly since many from Decapolis had already likely seen Jesus. We know in chapter 3, verses 7 and 8, that there were people on the other side of the Jordan and that likely who had come to see Jesus, and that likely included people from Decapolis. So they could have heard about him, maybe something here or there, but they might not have. And certainly, they didn't understand who this Jesus was, being Gentiles. They didn't understand or have a background of understanding who this Messiah was going to be and what to expect, like the Jews were wanting, were anticipating. They had, and many of them had to see what had happened for themselves. We see that this man was in his right mind, which has also been translated as he was sober. So he was somebody who had actually had was, again, in his right mind. He was sober-minded. Regardless, they were afraid of someone with such power. They tried everything to tame this demon-possessed man, but they couldn't. And Jesus comes onto their shores and does so immediately upon arriving, barely even breaking a sweat. Yeah.
They tried taking care of him by binding him. Jesus took care of him by setting him free.
Mm-hmm. True. Yeah.
One thing always worth mentioning whenever we run these situations of demon possession is that was a very unusual thing in the Bible. You don't see demon possession in the Old Testament for all intents and purposes. And you have a bloom of it, kind of an outbreak of it during the time of Jesus and immediately thereafter. And then by the second century, you stop hearing about it too.
Right.
So it's a situation that was very unusual. It was right around the time where Jesus was there, and the apostles were there, and supernatural gifts were there.
All right. They wonder, and in my mind, they are, if I'm in this situation and I'm thinking about this, if he could do this, something that they couldn't do, what other things could he do? After all, he did just effectively kill thousands of pigs. And the profit of the owners, and whatever profit the owners might have gotten for these pigs. So they begged him to leave, and of course he did. And then we note that the formerly demon-possessed man wants to go with Jesus. We might have time to get through this part. Wouldn't you want to go with someone who saved you from that torment? Wouldn't you want to go with someone like that? Interestingly enough, Jesus told him no, that he should tell everyone what the Lord has done for him. We note that the man still had friends. Despite all that had happened, he still had friends, it says in verse 19. Go home to your friends and tell them what great things the Lord has done for you. So, friend is another word for, is the noun form of the word for love. So, loved ones. Go tell your loved ones about this. Wow, he still, through all this, he still had people who loved him and cared about him. So, they wanted what was best for him, very clearly, but they couldn't think of what to do. He still had friends, despite what happened. And it so shows that the Lord did this out of compassion for the man. Compassion for him. Now, a question that we might not have time to answer today. If you've been in this class for a while, you know, remember what Jesus did with all the demons that had cast him, that he had cast out? He told them, don't tell people who I am. One. Two, do you remember what he told the leper in Mark chapter 1? Don't tell anybody about what happened, about what I've done. Why is this different? I think we're at a time, so I'm going to leave you with that question. Sorry, Dan. I'm going to leave you with that question, and we'll come back to that next time. Why on earth would this be different? All right.